Welcome to everyone on a rather cold evening. It's really a delight to be with you unexpectedly. I actually listened to a talk by Narayan some time ago, and it was titled something like Simplicity, Compassion, and Wisdom. And at the beginning of her talk, she said, how many people came here to listen to a talk on simplicity, compassion, and wisdom? And then she cutely said, oh, well. And she decided to give a talk on metta. So I don't know, for those of you who came here to listen to Narayan, oh well. She called me about 1 o'clock this afternoon, and she's sick, and so she's busily being a sick Buddha. You know, if you are disappointed, it's really a good practice. I mean, seriously, you know, it's like, well, you had this expectation, so you can see what expectations do. And then, you know, as often happens, life isn't what we expect. Our partner doesn't follow our script, and, you know, all this goes on. You know, this sort of, where does the disappointment come from? And how are we free of it? That's really what our practice is about, in a very both pragmatic and very deep sense. So this is pretty much a stream of consciousness talk because I really didn't have any time to do anything else. What I thought I'd do tonight is kind of touch lightly on some things that I think are helpful. And I'd like to deliberately make the talk short. I can easily blab away for a long time. So what I want to start with, how many people are relatively new to practice? Okay. And how many people know what the Four Noble Truths are? Okay. So I want to start by talking, just really going over in a fairly high level what the Four Noble Truths are. And actually, most scholars say that's about the worst imaginable translation of the Pali words Ariya Sancha. So maybe one alternative might be called the Four Ennobling Truths. You know, you might say, well, you know, the first, quote, ennobling or noble truth is there is dukkha. And we might ask ourselves, what is dukkha is usually translated as suffering or stress or dissatisfaction. And you might ask, well, what's so noble about that? Some people rationalize that translation as saying, well, it's noble to bear it, to stand under it. But I suspect that the better answer is that really it's understanding these truths in a really experiential way that's ennobling. And so it's a framework for practice. I mean, it's really very helpful to know these teachings. You know, the Buddha's laying out, here's the understanding I came to. This is his very first talk he gave. And it was a framework for his whole teaching the rest of his life. So in terms of practice and what leads to happiness and what leads to stress and dissatisfaction, if we kind of look at this framework as a way to understand how we can be more at ease with life and what causes stress and dissatisfaction, it's just a useful, it's really like a framework to practice with. And it's not to believe them. You know, he said, come see for yourself, is to investigate. Is this really true? So the first noble truth then, or ennobling truth, is there is dukkha. And dukkha is a Pali word, which is a textual language that the Buddha's teaching was written down in about 100 years after he died. And it's a very subtle word. It's usually translated as suffering. Ajahn Sinisero, who he says, well, yeah, it's too much like Rachmaninoff. You know, it's, oh, you know, my suffering, you know, it's too dramatic. So he likes to translate it as stress or a sense of dissatisfaction. But what the Buddha is really talking about in terms of dukkha is something so subtle that we wouldn't consider it suffering or stress. It's this kind of existential angst, in a sense. It's the sense of someone outside the experience. And we're so convinced that there's someone outside the experience. It's all happening to me, right? But that's a fabrication, a construction. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time going into detail tonight because I want to intentionally keep this talk short. But it's a story. You know, there's a memory of the past. There's projections of the future. There are thought processes. And we create this sense of identity. And it's not something to, you know, feel bad about. It's something that the neurological system constructs over and over and over again. And it's useful. And we have to have some sense of identity or something to function in this world. We can't just drop it all. And yet we also don't want to see life through it. We don't want to see life through our story, which is what most of us do. How things should be, how we are, etc. There's actually a nice book that someone lent me a week ago by David Lilley called something like The World of Stories. And beginning of the book, there is the statement is, the world is stories. And someone responds, no, the world is made of stories. That's what the title of the book, The World is Made of Stories. And then the response to that is, no, the world is made of atoms. And then the response to that is, that's one of our stories. So we need stories. We need to have concepts to move in this world. But we really also need to realize that they're just structures we fabricate. And to see how some of these fabrications and our attachment to them cause us to be dissatisfied. And so the second ennobling truth, and I'm going to call it that because I just think it's a better translation, is the cause. So the Buddha said, now he's not saying life is suffering. He's just saying there is dukkha. It's not personal. And that's really helpful sometimes to realize that that you're not the only one having a difficult time. It's part of the fact of life. And for some people, that's really a helpful way to lighten things, to see it's not so personal. Narayan used to teach, or she probably still does, that when you're really having some form of dukkha, to realize that this very moment, there's someone, and probably actually a lot of people, who are having exactly the same experience that you are. Now, when she told me that, I said, well, I tried that, but it wasn't very helpful. And she's an honest yogi. But over time, really, when you realize that's the human condition, it shifts things. So the second ennobling truth is there's a cause for this dukkha. And the cause is really actually stated as the cause is tanha. It's a Pali word that gets translated as an unquenchable thirst. And usually in English is maybe, well, that's the etymology, is an unquenchable thirst. So it usually gets translated as craving. And then people start using the word desire instead of craving. And desire is has a lot of meanings in English. So it gets to be somewhat unskillful to use that word. There's, you know, more neutral words for what we would call a desire to do something, as opposed to this kind of desire to have things a certain way. Okay. So when this the usefulness of this framework is, okay, you got to watch out. Notice when there's some sort of dukkha. And then ask yourself why. And the Buddha's saying the reason why is craving. And you say, well, craving for what? And he, you know, there's this very detailed discussion of this. We could spend a whole talk on just this one particular aspect of it. But one, he says, craving for sense pleasures. You know, maybe you were sitting here tonight and your knees started hurting and you didn't want to have your knees hurting, so you move, or maybe don't move, and maybe the mind reacts or something like that. Everything changes. That's part of the form of dukkha. You know, everything's unreliable. That's a particular kind of dukkha. And so if everything's changing, trying to rearrange our lives all the time so that we only have pleasant emotional experiences, we only have pleasant physical experiences, it's not going to work. And so really a big part of the practice is learning to open to what's here. Right now, this very moment, this is the freedom that's being offered. Not to have, you know, it's presence. It's this power of being in this, what Eckhart Tolle calls the now. And that's, you know, it's very simple. But boy, it's hard to do, right? We have overwhelming emotions. We have physical pain, illness. You know, my response to Narayan is, well, be a sick Buddha. And she just laughed, right? Because it's just to be fully sick. Drop the story. Open to it. How does it feel? Notice it. Another aspect of this craving is a craving for identity. It's a story of who we are. And usually a story of who we are is, there's a movie, you've been weighed and measured and woefully inadequate, found to be woefully inadequate. It's the biggest, I mean, if you feel woefully inadequate or even slightly inadequate, join the club. It is the biggest issue of meditators. And I don't care if they're 18 or 80. It's just pervasive, this inner critic. And so we might ask, who is this inner critic and where does it come from? Yeah, Eckhart Tolle, who, you know, supposedly became awakened, asking a question similar to that. He was really depressed. And then he thought, and there's this other part, he was really upset with the fact that he's really depressed. And then he said, well, maybe there's only one of me. Who is this inner critic that's telling the other person in there that you're not enough? Where did that come from? So really to look at this kind of how we're trying to create some identity. We're trying to present ourselves. Of course, where does it come from? Well, part of where it comes from is, you know, we're all conditioned by all the advertising in this world. We go to, we take classes, we get graded, weighed and measured all the time, and we're objectified. And we turn ourselves into an object. And so to work with that, to just open to that, to see it, to allow it to be there, not to feed it, and to see it's really just a thought, isn't it? But it's really a powerful thought. I better be careful or I'll give a full talk here tonight. So this sense of it, and sometimes you might feel, actually, you might think you're really a good person, that you're really smart and intelligent and beautiful and personable, and you know what? Then you got to hold that image up. You know, what happens when, you know, you get sick or you lose some of your skills or something? That falls apart too. And what would be there if there was no identity? And part of holding on to that identity is the fear of there won't be anything there. And yet what's there is this boundless, timeless, compassionate, there's no language for it. Then when we drop this sense of self, when we don't have to be, you know, good enough or we're not, you know, whether we're either good enough or not good enough, when we don't have to be either of those, there's an immense freedom from that. So our practice can be to start looking at how we create this identity. Every time we see that we're having some sort of dukkha, well, are we trying to get a sense pleasure? Is there some identity we're trying to defend? Or other aspects of identity or views, opinions? You know, I have this little feed on my computer that it's an application that sends me all these articles that thinks I might be like to read. And it gets to know you, right? So I get all this really left-wing stuff that's, you know, okay, now you have my bias, right? You know, very critical of what's going on in the world, right? And that's fine. I mean, it's useful to be informed, but not to be attached to it. You know, my wife's a kind of an activist, and she, you know, so she wants, I think, look, I know this. I don't need to see one more documentary about, you know, all this is going on. It's not to deny it, but is that really skillful to spend all your time focusing on it, telling a story? Look at the energy behind it. So these are really kind of simple things, really, you know. Just looking at our stories and see which ones make us feel uplifted and which ones of us make us feel down, stressed. What's the energy like? And then the third kind of craving is craving for non-existence, the form of depression. I don't want to be here anymore, which is another I, right? It's another identity. It's Eckhart Tolle calls it the pain body. It feeds on you. And if you don't identify with it, it loses its power. Okay, so there's dukkha, there's a cause, craving, sense pleasures, identity. And then the third, this is really beautiful. There is cessation. An end is possible. That's what he's promising. I teach one thing and one thing only, dukkha and the end of dukkha. He's actually saying it's possible to be free of this. And how? Well, then that's the fourth ennobling truth. There's a way, this eightfold path, which isn't really like a sequence, but components of a practice. And the path has three major components to it, a wisdom piece, an ethical piece, and developing what we might call samadhi or calm. The wisdom piece, the first part of the wisdom, and so first of all, this is a conceptual framework he's providing you. Okay, here's the framework, work with it. The first wisdom piece is what's called right view, which is a translation of the word sama. I actually don't really like right too much. It's got kind of much a flavor of, you know, good or bad. And one translation of the word is harmonious view, which I prefer. And all these things are preceded by some sort of sama this, so it's either right or correct or complete or, you know, it's a translation problem. I just like harmonious. And so what's a harmonious view? And there's kind of two levels at which that's talked about. One is cause and effect. If we behave in a certain way, you get a certain result. Now, it might not always be obvious that that's the case, but it's a psychological thing. It's not so much some cosmological principle or something like that, or, you know, what happens to you as a result of the way you behave. There's all, you know, the Buddha actually said that, well, karma, which is kind of this word for cause and effect, karma vipaka, he said, well, you know, it has a little effect, and there's all these other things that go on, just the things that the situation we're born into. He's not saying that's the result of the way we behaved in past lives, etc., although it's often talked about that way. So we can start looking at cause and effect and see what ways of behaving leads to peace and happiness and what ways lead to stress and dissatisfaction. So there's a view there to do that. There is a causality. And the other aspect, sometimes that's called the mundane harmonious view. And then there's super mundane harmonious view, which is no separation. Which, remember, I said that the more subtle definition of dukkha is a sense of someone outside the experience. So how do we create the sense of someone outside the experience? By resistance, by craving, by not wanting things to be the way they are in this moment. So we're always kind of looking, from a practice perspective, we can look and say, well, are we separating from things? There's a me who doesn't want things to be this way. Isn't that what this dukkha is, right? Psychologically, or there's something that we don't want to be the way it is. And so this gets talked about in many ways, sometimes with the word is acceptance, surrender. They just finished the sandwich retreat last week, which is a retreat that starts one weekend, and people come and meet, you know, during the evenings, and then the next weekend. And for the last 3 years, the topic of the sandwich retreat has been resistance, to see when you're resisting things. And what's the resistance? Well, it's sometimes you could talk about it as any form of negativity, aversion. But But more broadly, it's any sense of not being present in this very moment, just the way it is. You know, it's not only just aversion. I mean, if you want things to be a certain way, you're kind of resisting the way things are at this moment. Or even if you're trying to hold on to a pleasant experience, oh, it feels good, you know, I want to keep it, it causes some sense of dissatisfaction. So when we drop that, just this presence of just, this is how it is, there's something boundless there. So that's the first part of right view. The second part is forming the intention based on that view to behave in a certain way. And the Buddha is saying, well, if we behave in a way that we're kind and compassionate, if we don't act out of places of greed and hatred, then that will lead to a state of inner peace. And so we can kind of look at that. And actually, just feel energetically how those different forms of behavior affect how we are, and to see, you know, how when we interact with people from one place versus the other, what's the long-term effect of that? If we act out of kindness and compassion, there's a sense of connection, of non-separation. Okay. So then, you know, then the intention gets into kind of actions, which are about how we speak in the world. So basically there's like, we want to speak from a place of truth, kindness, timeliness. I'm going to miss one now. Beneficial. Okay. So it's useful to check, you know, are we speaking in a kind, and this stuff doesn't just mean to other people. It means also how we're treating ourselves. You know, are we being kind to ourselves? And it's not that in a judgmental way. It's to see energetically how it feels for us, what it does for us. Okay. And in a way, you know, the Buddha, then the third part of this Eightfold Path is samadhi, what we've been sitting here doing for the first 45 minutes for those who came, is trying to develop a sense of calm and ease. It's not supposed to be a torture chamber, believe it or not, you know. And so it's really useful to find a way to make it good for yourself. You know, say you find a bench, you sit on a chair, you work with your posture, and most importantly, you work with the breath. It's not just an object of meditation. It's not just an object to focus on. It's actually the way we breathe affects the way our body feels, our energetic level. So developing a skillful way of breathing and just sitting and, you know, we start learning after a while, you can actually move the breath through different parts of the body and make yourself feel better. And a lot of what the Buddha taught really is to generate what he called right karma, right results. And, you know, if you see how you behave in a certain way and it generates bright results, then it's a good thing to do, right? I have this example. I got to come up with a new one soon because everybody's going to have heard it at this point. But I was teaching the elders group, and I said, "We're always talking about dukkha. Why don't we talk about, you know?" And so I said, "Okay, you know, let's do some stuff of kindness and compassion." And I told them a story about. Or actually, right after that, I went to the grocery store. I was in Whole Foods, and this little old lady was there, and she was. I mean, she was, you know, just really in bad shape. And she was trying to get by some milk. And her hand was reaching her milk light and just shaking, you know. And she came over to me. She said, "Could you read the date, expiration date for me?" And I did. And I suggested there's some other milk that doesn't expire as fast. And she gave me a really nice smile, you know. And she, even though her body was falling apart, she was really with it, actually, you know. And it felt good. So we start paying attention to, you know, we do simple things like open the door for people or just listen to someone. Not with the objective of getting something from it, just because that's actually underlying all this defensive stuff that's there and stress. there's really, it's really then our natural way of being. I'm going to teach a course. In order to sell a course, I had to throw in some neuroscience and all this sort of thing, because I was told the course had to be hot, hot topic. So I've been kind of rereading some neuroscience, and there's a book by Rick Hansen, which I don't recommend, by the way. he did write a book called Buddha's Brain, which I think is great. It's really the most simplest. I mean, it's just a really straightforward presentation of practice. I think it's quite beautiful. But this book was a follow-up on that, and it's called Hardwiring Happiness. And it's got really good ideas in it. It's just that it's about this thick with big print, and everything's repeated 10,000 times. And if you're like me, a cut-to-the-chase kind of guy, it could have been a chapter. But it has some beautiful ideas, and it's so supportive of the teaching of this practice. Basically, he says, have good experiences. Actually, to deliberately look for them. They're the things we just kind of move through and we don't pay attention to. Maybe a hot cup of tea or coffee, or just to really taste of that, or maybe someone says something nice, or you know, whatever it is that kind of makes the energy feel good. To actually deliberately cultivate doing that and noticing and being aware of it. And, you know, this is a little tricky, because then you can start doing that, and, oh, it didn't work. But so then after that, he says, basically enhance it. And by enhance it, I mean, how many ways can you take it in? There's a thought process. There's just a sense of heart that feels it. There's a bodily type sort of thing. So the more kind of sense experiences we have, or the more ways we experience that uplifting moment, the more we take it in. And then he's actually saying absorb it. Just really hold it. Be with it. And basically what neuroscience is, you know, because for survival, we focus on the negative. I mean, you know, if there's some wind blowing in the grass and you just assume it's wind and it's actually a Bengal tiger, you got a problem, right? But, you know, if it's... So you know, you sort of assume that, well, maybe there's a Bengal tiger there, I better da-da-da. But, you know, we don't have, I mean, actually Larry Rosenberg said that the Bengal tigers in the West are relationships. But you know, for the most part, you know, it's not, they're not Bengal tigers running around. And what happens is, because we're so conditioned, I mean, just really the way we've evolved to take in a negative, it's kind of got a heavy, you know, it's not pleasant. So it actually takes longer to take in the good. And so that's a nice little practice. Take in the good. Actually go through the day taking in the good. Notice these places that are really good for you. And enhance them, absorb them. Now, actually, has it, you know, acronyms are great. So he has an acronym. It's called HEAL. You know, so have a good experience, enhance it, absorb it. And the L is interesting too, because the L is the link. This is really a stretch, but anyway, what he basically says is, when you really do create all these good experiences, and you're kind of feeling uplifted, and maybe there's something that triggers you, maybe a particular kind of person or a particular person or whatever it is that triggers some negativity, then bring that up. And what he's saying is, what actually happens is that over time, these good experiences erase this underlying conditioned negativity. So this is stuff that's, you know, the Buddha's teaching is actually neuroscience is coming out and finding. We cultivate kindness, compassion, we take in the good, that it really is good for us. This is a no-brainer, right? But we don't live that way. You know, we live like, well, if you get this done, and, you know, we're all evaluated on getting, accomplishing things, and then we're never really here. Okay. It's getting long. Okay. So, I did get through the Four Noble Truths. Now, what I wanted to then say a little bit about mindfulness. You know, it's like, it's just all over the place. You know, it's in the checkout counter now. I mean, and You know, in Buddhism, mindfulness is a translation of this Pali word sati. And it's a very complex word, just like dukkha is. And it depends on contextually how it gets used. But I think there's some things that to keep in mind about what the particular word means. Because when you say, well, practice mindfulness, usually people think that means, well, be aware of what you're doing right now, which is true to some extent, but it's more than that. It has to do with memory, of recollecting. So it's trying to remember to do something. Remember what? Well, if you're trying to develop calm and you're sitting and doing meditation, then it might be you remember to come back to your meditation object, right? Remember to come back to the breath. So it's kind of a monitoring function. Are you there? No. Come back. That's all. But more broadly, it means to remember the Four Noble Truths. In other words, this is a framework to look at why, you know, there's difficulty. And say, okay, is there, and one is to see that there's difficulty. And then to work with it with these teachings. Okay, there's a nice acronym, which this one I don't think is such a stretch, called RAIN. And it means to recognize, accept or allow, investigate, and not identify with. It's really simple. It's something that, you know, you can start taking into your practice relatively new. And I've had practitioners say, well, I've been doing this all these years, but that's really great, you know. So just kind of running, just keeping in mind to recognize, is there some sort of dukkha happening? Because most of the time, we get lost in it. We don't even know, right? And then to accept or allow is kind of this second ennobling truth, right? Rather than trying to push it away or da-da-da, we open to it. Now, it's not opening to it in the sense of resignation. It's just opening to, this is how things are at this moment. Eckhart Tolle has a nice little example of, you get stuck in the mud. And now you could be really angry about it and all this sort of thing. Does that really help? Yeah. So, it's not that, okay, we're stuck in the mud and then, what do I need to do to get out of it? So if you can really be present with things rather than being reactive, we can come to some understanding of why there's a problem and then move out of wisdom to deal with it, if you can. You know, there's a good thing some people say, well, if you got something you're worried about, either do something about it or allow it, right? It's like kind of like the serenity prayer. So there's R, recognize, A, allow. I is to investigate. Why is there dukkha here? What's it like? You know, if there's disappointment because Narayan didn't come tonight, and now you got to listen to me, it's, well, why? Why is there some suffering out of that? Where is it? Is it in the mind? Is it in the body? Is it in the heart? Is it a felt sense? And one of the things we can start doing is seeing the story we have that's keeping it going. Too bad. Now I got to listen to this, and I might as well not grump about it, and not identify. Well, let me go a little more in the investigation, and we could talk a lot about that. But part of the investigation is to see that it's changing. And actually, one of the things you'll see is when you're in a story, when you're up in the head, that's what feeds it. And a lot of times we go in the head because it's unpleasant. And rather than feel the emotional part that's going on, we tell a story about it. Okay? And we just get caught up in this conceptual story. But that actually keeps it going. So what we want to do in the investigation is, there's a story, da-da. Let's come down to the body and feel it. And where in the body do we feel it? What's the heart like? So this, and is not identify. It's actually this, just see, and this is, again, the sense of someone outside the experience. Just to see, this is a process that's going on. It's like a whole bunch of programs. Okay. Now, this is not, we can talk about not self all that, and then you say, this is not self stuff. Well, it feels like there's a self here now, right? Especially when there's something really difficult happening. And actually, the Buddha, it's interesting because when he did the teaching of not self, it was really a counter to this Hindu belief of a Brahman, this eternal soul. And there are discourses where people ask him, is there a self or not a self? And he refuses to answer. Because it's just all this dualistic language. But it's a nice psychological way of, you know, when we're not identifying as me and mine, there's a little more spaciousness to it. Okay. So, to do all this, we have to be aware of what's going on. This is another translation of Pali word sati. And I don't know, I've obsessed about what this word meant at one time. But one way to talk about it is it's kind of an awareness that's broader than just a brief attention. It's being with things enough to see what's going on. You know, if your attention's there and then it's here, there, you don't even see that things are changing. You're just flipping between, and you don't come to any understanding of it. So that's the kind of awareness. And it's not just a a mental awareness. You know, the mindfulness is holistic. Ajahn Suchito uses a model which I find very helpful for both practice and in part to deconstruct this sense of identity, which is basically, if you think about what we are, and this is just one particular way of doing it, as some processes, some intelligent processes. So there's a conceptual piece, right? This is useful. You know, it's sort of, it plans, it organizes. You know, you have to be at a certain place a certain time. I mean, we wouldn't have this discussion if there weren't. Of course, we might not need it if we didn't have this conceptual piece. But and of course, it also does things like worry, judge, think about not thinking. You know, all sorts of other things that are really just useless. They burn up a lot of energy. It's just constant thinking. It's actually draining. You know, you come back from work and you really haven't done much physically and drain. I mean, it actually, there's a tremendous amount of energy used by a thought process. So there's this conceptual piece. That's one part of the process. And then there's this heart piece. It's this felt sense of things. It's this, you know, it includes a lot of things. It includes emotions, but also includes kind of this intuitive intelligence. You know, a lot of times, I mean, it's what gets us here, right? It doesn't feel right. There's something wrong. And you know, there's some sort of hope, belief, maybe we can be better than this, okay? So there's this heart, you want to pay attention to what the felt sense of things are, rather than behaving from the thought process. Because a lot of times what happens is we get in the thought process, got to get this done, da-da-da, you know, and just push aside how it feels. And then life just doesn't feel very good. Because we're ignoring this felt sense of things about what really is heartful for us. And then the third piece is the body. The body's our ground. I mean, if you get nothing else out of coming here tonight, be in the body. It's the first focus or foundation of mindfulness. And it's interesting because the Buddha says, you know, be aware of the body in the body. And you might ask, well, what does that mean? It means to feel the body. Don't look down upon it and da-da-da-da, but actually, what's it feel like? And really, you know, is this practice something that we're sitting and doing meditation rather than trying to just be with the breath or something? We can start noticing all aspects of the body. And actually looking at the body as if we didn't even know. We had no, drop all conceptions of what the body is. And then, you know, with your eyes closed, what does it feel like? It's constantly changing. It's got energies. Where does the boundary come from? So being in the body is our ground. It discharges our emotions. And if we're in the body, then the mind spins less. And if the mind spins less, it doesn't have as many chances to find trouble. You know? So we got rain. And so what we have to do is we bring this holistic awareness to this rain in a way. You know, not just the intellectual piece of it, but what's it feel like to the heart? What's it feel like to the body? Okay. Okay. Okay, I could go on, but I think I'm going to stop and just sort of, you know, have a lot of time for questions, because I think, you know, what this practice is, and I'll let you ask your question in a second if you want, is about, it's about being free of suffering. And we can all in here, we're all deal with challenges. I don't think, you know, maybe there's someone who, you know, like the Buddha, who allegedly was totally free of all this. I gave a talk last talk I gave was exploring this issue. But it's kind of really, after a while, starting to see when we're caught. So how fast do we see we're caught? And then seeing how we can get free of that. And sometimes the freedom of that is just to see, oh, there's resistance here, and just accepting the resistance, not piling anything else on top of it. Ah, this is how things are. You know, ah, I'm a sad Buddha, I'm a angry Buddha, whatever. You know, just be completely that. That's what's happening this moment. Okay. You want to get started? Yeah. Almost any time the word I or should appears, there's sort of a story here about an identity. And it's all happening to me, right? There's a sense of the world and, you know, the other person and all that. And that's who I am. But what you really are is a dynamic process. Now you're this dynamic process of body, heart, and mind from this holistic awareness perspective. That's one way of looking at it. You're a fabrication of stories. You know, the stories about who you were, who you're going to be, what might happen to you. You know, fabrication of all the other people. Those are all kind of sense of identity. So if you actually just see them as thoughts, rather than seeing the world through the thoughts, that's very freeing. That says that, I mean, another way to put it is there's nothing solid here. There is no solid you. There's no you that's independent of things. For example, you know, we're sitting here and having a conversation, right? Well, we couldn't have a conversation if one of us wasn't here. So we might think of it we're separate, but we're really not. I mean, or, you know, maybe I disappear. Well, you're still not separate from what's going on. There's not a you that's independent of the outside. You know, if, what are you that moment? Sound, right? That's all there is. There's this hearing or heard. Sounds are, you know, I'm a Zen master. I remember took a mock tot one day and I was on a long retreat and just hits it. At that very moment he hits it, there's nothing but sound. And then the mind infers, I heard the sound. It's a fabrication of the mind. Where's the sound taking place? Well, it comes, you know, through the ears, vibrations get sent to somewhere in the brain. And, vision's even better. You know, we're sitting here, you know, maybe you see me and I'm so far away from you. And, you know, visual consciousness does that. Where's the vision taking place? It's in the back of the head somewhere, right? But you're sort of saying, I'm here, and you're there. What the mind does after the fact is say, oh, I see him. But that's a fabrication, it's a construction. So every time you started getting locked around, you can see, look for stories, sense of this is how things are, all that views, opinions, they're always memories, projections, they're all sense of identity. And if you start seeing those as fabrications, as stories, and you know, it's not that we shouldn't have stories, but to see what stories lead to suffering and stress. So it's not claiming those things as you. I guess maybe for me, I remember it was a very vivid experience. I was on a long retreat and I sort of thought I was going to have a good sitting, you know, which is really a setup. It was late in the evening, you know. And I was trying to concentrate. And there's all this striving going on, right? You know, the mind's just wandering, right? And then I thought, none of this is me or mine. And then there's immense release from it. I mean, it's interesting because in the discourse on mindfulness, at least the first three parts of it, The Buddha doesn't say do anything. It's just be aware of it. That's actually a form of love. Oh, the mind is distracted. Oh, the mind is concentrated. You know, the mind is irritated. The mind's not irritated. And you just kind of, this is how it is right now. You know, rather than, the mind shouldn't be like this, right? It's a mental, the mind is, I mean, the sense that you are this mind, what is it? Where does this mind get created? It's just a thought process, right?
Okay, I'll try and speak in the big microphone. If a person is married, they tend to live a little bit longer.
Just stay here for a moment. Just end this question, and we'll take a break for people.
I just want to say that there's a reality here that is beyond my saying, "Oh, that's not really me." There is a really me.
Well, but it's not solid, is it?
I'm this mammal, and I have needs. I thrive in certain circumstances, and I don't thrive under others.
Right. So you clearly have to take care of this mammal. Okay. I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is that the part that says, "Well, I had this history, and that the world should be like this, this view and opinion," that's a fabrication. It's a fabrication that causes trouble a lot of times. It's a thought. Okay. So this is a really tricky business because if you really get in deep into meditation, the sense of someone outside the experience falls away. Okay, so it's not that there isn't a body and there isn't all that going on, but this thinking that says this is some solid me is a fabrication. And I don't know how to convince you of that, because unless you experience it, I'm not talking about something experientially, okay? That notice every time you think there's a you, where did that you come from? I mean, pick some particular example, for example, that you're suffering. Give me some example when you have stress or dissatisfaction.
Yeah, stress is it. I'm in traffic, and that guy's honking 150 times right behind me.
Right.
And there's that guy on the bike dressed in black, and it's dark, and he's zooming right in front of me, and all that stuff.
Right.
And I'm beginning to go, uh-oh. And yeah. I better be careful here, or I'm going to get mad, or what, you know.
Right. So there's a kind of fabrication here, right? The truth is, guy's blowing a horn at you. I mean, I was coming over here one time. I was really late. This woman going through to Harvard, and some woman's like driving 10 miles an hour, right? You know, and I want to get here on time. And then I got here, and the staff bathroom was broken. but there's a reactivity there. It's a mental process. It's a view about how things should be. These horns shouldn't be blowing, these bikers shouldn't be doing this, and it causes stress. And if you just see that these are just thoughts, and that maybe even there's, you know, even below that, there's a visceral reaction to it, right? You know, someone blows a horn at you, there's a tightening of the body.
What I'm trying to say is that person who is married and gets to live 5 years longer, I don't know why he lives 5 years longer, but that's research. That's not just a thought. That's a real experience.
Absolutely.
And
it's just that it doesn't belong to anybody.
Right. Okay, I agree.
Got it?
That
okay.
Was a good line. Yeah.
In other words, it's a dynamic process, you know? I mean, do you look like you were when you were 2 months old? Of course not, right? I was on a long retreat one time, and I had this thought, well, what will it be like when I get old? I'm here now. But, you know, it was a while ago. And I thought, well, I won't be here. You know, there's this mind-body process will be here. It doesn't belong to anybody. The fact that it belongs to someone is a fabrication. That's the thing. And when you, I want to move beyond the theoretical piece of this. I mean, who cares, right? I mean, does it make your life easier not to claim this is you? So maybe I give a lousy talk here, right? And then I can go home and say, oh boy, I gave a horrible talk and people are all disappointed, and they'll never, that's a fabrication. There's a sense of identity of Ron who wants to give a good talk and be approved of and all these things, right? Those are fabrications. And they cause a lot of suffering. Not good enough. Got to accomplish this. Does that make sense? Yeah, okay. All right, so people who want to leave, you can do so now, and the rest of you want to stretch a little bit, and the rest of you want to stay, and we'll have a discussion, okay?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.